It's 2:08 here on WWL Radio. In the 3 o'clock hour, I'm going to give out the Jazz Fest code word of the day. You can keep listening between now and then, why don't you? I'll give it out in the 3 o'clock hour, but, you know, just broadly know that every weekday at 3 o'clock, we're going to give out the code word on this program. Also going to give out code words at 9, noon, and 6 p.m. In a few minutes, we're going to get to talk to Ellie Reeve, who's an award-winning journalist and the author of a book called Black Pill: How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. We're going to call kind of an audible here, Coleman. This is the segment where traditionally we would do the news bomb. I don't want to get jammed up with Ellie because I've been working on this booking for a long time, and I don't want to run out of time with her. So we'll do that a little bit later. And in the next few minutes, before we step away, we can keep talking about Kilmer Abrego Garcia. Here's a text that says, Ian, he's a Salvadoran citizen. If he's innocent, the Salvadorans let him out. The reason he fled is he's from another gang. Oh, sorry. No, the reason he fled is from another gang that was at war with MS-13 at the very best. So, yeah, there are some other folks texting in suggesting that, you know, if he's not an MS-13 and he is in danger from MS-13, then he must therefore be a member of a different gang. MS-14 or 15. I don't know. I just made those up. But you get my point, right? People are saying that if he's not a member of MS-13, it follows that he's a member of another gang. Which, okay, but MS-13 threatens and kills people all the time that are not members of any gang. If you know anything about gang violence, even just from like watching TV, you know, the cartels kill journalists and politicians and regular business people that get in their way or that don't do what they want. Just because you got killed by MS-13 does not mean that you are a member of a gang. Here's another text that says, Ian, bottom line, what people don't understand is that whatever this guy did, he already had some kind of process done and he was granted a somewhat legal status, whether it was temporary or not. The question here is, does any legal process mean anything anymore? Like, people show up to their court dates, their immigration meetings, etc. They're walking around on the streets with a 2-year parole thinking that they're legal, and they are getting deported regardless. Does the American word or law mean anything anymore? That's a great point. And another thing that's getting kind of buried in the amount of sort of noise and fury about Mr. Abrego Garcia is that we're out here thinking that as high a number as 75% of the people that have been sent to this El Salvador prison by the Trump administration have no criminal record at all. Think about that. He said, we're going to go after the worst people first. We're going to start with the people that we know are in the country illegally and that have a criminal record. But what little information we have about the people that they've snatched up and sent to this torture prison in El Salvador with no trial, no due process, no nothing like that. 75% of those people have no criminal record at all. And I wouldn't put it past this administration to even be scooping up people like Mr. Abrego Garcia that have some sort of legal protected status, whether it's temporary or not, whether you agree with the vibe of that or not. The law is the law, man. Let's go back to the Oakland Jewelers talk and text line, 504-260-1870, where we find David calling in from Atlanta. Welcome back, David. It's been a minute.
Thank you very much. You know, Trump announced today, evidently, he wants to put tariffs on imported drugs, generic drugs. 90% of the drugs imported into this country come from foreign countries. That means Medicare and Medicaid and consumers are going to have to put out a lot more. But let me tell you something. I'm 76 years of age. I've been in the financial markets more than 50 years. It's something I virtually do for a living. Now, I know what I'm talking about, but I'll tell you something else. There was a gentleman on CNBC yesterday. He's the founder of the world's largest hedge fund. No doubt he's a multi-billionaire. He said he's not worried about a recession. He's worried about a depression. Now, let me tell you what his thinking is. In the month of June, the United States Treasury will have to refinance $6 trillion of Treasury obligations. Now, I've been buying gold like there's no tomorrow, and I've been buying gold mining shares like there's no tomorrow, and I've been shorting the dollar like there's no tomorrow. I've been buying the Swiss franc like there's no tomorrow. I've been buying the euro like there's no tomorrow. And I've been buying the Japanese yen like no tomorrow. And let me tell you why these things are happening. United States, no doubt, is headed for inflation, thanks to Donald Trump. Now, when inflation goes up, gold goes up, because gold is the currency of last resort. And the dollar is weak. Now, with this worldwide trade star, trade war that Trump evidently is trying to start, a lot of countries are going to get away from the dollar as punishment to the United States. And if the United States dollar is the world reserve currency, banks all over the world own dollars. Now, when the dollar weakens, they lose money. Now, if they switch to a different currency, it's going to be a catastrophe, and that's right. Only in the beginning.
Yeah.
In June, when these debt obligations have to be financed, suppose the 30-year bond is yielding 5% right now. Well, there's going to be an auction in June. Suppose the only people who wish, and we got to sell those bonds, we have to refinance the debt at any cost, at any price. What happens if those buyers show up at the auction and bid where the bond would yield 10%. We're already paying more in interest on the debt than on defense spending. The dollar will collapse, gold will go up, and I think what would happen would make 1929 look like a stock market rally. Mm. I mean, Trump doesn't know what he's doing, and he's playing with fire. And one other quick thing about this genius governor.
Okay, quick though.
He's blaming Morris Bort. Well, he needs to look to his hero in Washington at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. You know, when you get into a car crash, what happens? You need car parts like a bumper, a fender, a windshield, mm-hmm. a radiator. Well, many of those car parts come from Canada, China, Mexico, and other places. Trump's putting tariffs on that. So guess what? Insurance rates will go up in Louisiana, because when somebody gets in a car crash, those parts are going to cost a lot more money for the insurance companies to replace.
You got it. David, I got to pause it there, but it's good to hear from you, man. Thank you for being a part of the show today. I have a lot of learning to do about the bond market. You know, like we say on this program all the time, I'm not a financial expert, but I do listen to financial experts, and they're really hitting the alarm button on that. So we'll have time, I think, later in the week to dive into that a little bit more. But first, I want to do some reading. When we come back, we'll be speaking to Ellie Reeve. And she is the author of Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society and Capture American Politics. Looking forward to this. We'll be right back. I'm Ian Hilken for Scoot. 220 on WWL, and my guest is Ellie Reeve. Ellie first came to my attention for the breakout HBO and Vice documentary called Charlottesville, Race and Terror, that earned her a Peabody, an Emmy, and made her one of the most recognizable journalists covering the far right in America. She's built her career going face to face with white supremacists, misogynists, political extremists, conspiracy theorists, and internet radicals, not from a comfortable distance, not from some elite coastal enclave, but actually in the room with them, in the car with them, in the street with them, asking the hard questions and often earning their trust in the process. She's now out with a new book called Black Pill, which I found to be a chilling read, a clear-eyed investigation into the online ecosystem where so many young men just find themselves caught in this death spiral of hopelessness and misogyny and anger. It's a book about those men and sometimes women falling down these digital rabbit holes and what that means for the rest of us. Welcome to the show, Ellie. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. You may remember in The Matrix, at the moment that the rebel leader Morpheus is giving Neo a choice to either join his movement or go back to his fake, pointless life in The Matrix. He says, you take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. If you take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. That is where we get the sort of red pill, blue pill terminology. Ellie, tell us about the black pill. What does a black-pilled person look like?
Well, that pill suffix proved to be a very useful term on the internet. Like, you could be crypto-pilled, meaning you like crypto, or Russia-pilled, meaning you think Russia explains politics today. Black-pilled, though, is more of a feeling of gleeful nihilism. It's the desire to watch it all burn because you think society is hopelessly corrupt all around you. And so the only way to get something better is for everything to fall apart, because what comes after will be much better.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you quote the Joker there when he said in The Dark Knight, some people just want to watch the world burn. There's one passage in the book that really stuck with me when I read it. You describe a movement that is dedicated to, quote, making the world a more cruel, divided, and violent place. Do black-pilled people care if they get burned while they're busy burning the world down?
Well, yes and no. Like, they, on the one hand, feel like, well, there's nothing to live for in the present, that their life is meaningless. Mm-hmm. They're working a job they don't like. They're buying garbage on Amazon. Maybe they're unemployed. They just are on the computer all day. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what they have now is not worth keeping. So, yeah, maybe they'll get hurt in the process, but that's worth it to them.
Yeah. One of the other big takeaways.
In fact, I even had a guy tell me, you know, like, he's had a gun pointed at him so many times. He's been tapping his foot waiting for martyrdom, but it hasn't happened yet.
So much of the discord in our society is about politics, but a lot of the discord that I'm thinking about now after having read your book is politics adjacent, I guess, but at its root, it's not about politics at all. It's about alienation, hopelessness, and despair. How did one become the other? How did this become a political discussion?
Yeah, that's been the thing I've been so fascinated with for a decade now. You know, feeling like it's hard to find meaning in modern life. That's not crazy. A lot of people feel that way. And that's why these groups are able to recruit. You know, they're not talking about imaginary problems. They're talking about real things people are feeling. Men not knowing how to be men. Men not understanding why women don't want to date them. Young men especially seeing their families fall apart and not understanding why that's happening and thinking something radical must be done to preserve them.
Mm-hmm. They see them.
Like, at the root of all of the stuff that I've studied has been the relationships between men and women and the desire for order and happiness within a family.
I want to talk more about the groups that you mentioned there in just a bit, but let's drill down a little bit further on what they're looking for. Is it connection, it's control, it's a sense of meaning, or are they just trying to fight back against what they feel has put them in the situation where they're in? Perhaps that's feminism or liberalism or something else. If you strip away the ideological component, they're just looking for connection and control and camaraderie, right?
Right. So I spoke to one former member of the Proud Boys who said that a lot of the guys in that group, they wanted to get together and feel like they had a brotherhood. Like, they'd never felt like they had a wingman, someone who had their back. They wanted to be able to pick a fight in the bar and not be afraid that they couldn't back that up, because they'd have guys behind them. Another guy in the white nationalist movement, you know, his wife had very difficult and complicated medical problems. He felt like his immediate family was falling apart. You know, so he's, even as his home life is crumbling, he's writing in public, like, we need to have white nationalism. We need to expel people who are immigrants to this country because we need to bring order to the traditional family and bring more sort of respectability to white people.
Mm-hmm. And so these groups like the Proud Boys and, well, tell us about some of the other organizations that are actually, you know, have names, have people attached to them that we would recognize from their faces and names in the media. Who else are we talking about here that's blackpilling young men?
Well, the guys in the white polo shirts from Charlottesville who are marching with tiki torches, those were mostly called from a group called Identity Europa. And it wanted to present itself as aspirational, as like GQ magazine, as handsome, physically fit men who are not anti-everyone else, but just pro-white and pro-family. And that is how they were able to recruit. Behind the scenes, they were sharing horrible anti-Semitic, like Holocaust memes, racism, the worst stuff you can imagine on the internet. But in public, they wanted to look like they had dignity. And that is what drew so many of the people I talked to. Richard Spencer is another person I interview. He became known as sort of preeminent, like, professional racist. He says he's now not a white nationalist anymore, but you might know him for two things: hailing Trump after the 2016 election and getting punched in the face during Trump's inauguration in 2017. Mm-hmm. Another group is called Traditionalist Workers Party. They wanted to be more working class. You know, I mean, I see some of these themes in mainstream politics today. They wanted to bring back those factory jobs. They wanted to uplift the working class. They wanted traditional roles for gender, for mothers. And they, most of these guys were actually like middle class guys, like their dads were lawyers and teachers and stuff. But they would wear Dickies. You know, they would kind of dress up and almost like in costume as the working class.
Mm-hmm. And how fast do people kind of get sucked into this? How they go from sort of just being curious, like, oh, I read about this on some place on the internet, on Reddit or on Discord or on 4chan. I'm going to learn a little bit more about this. And then, you know, you blink twice and they're a full on extremist, you know, screaming Jews will not replace us. What does that journey look like for the most part?
What I heard over and over again was it started as a joke and then became real. That has been the entry point for every group that I've looked at, completely disconnected ones, whether it's gun rights or white nationalism or incels that's involuntarily celibate. One woman described to me the process being is she gets into this group chat, essentially, and there's these horrible jokes happening about the Holocaust. And she recoils, and people tell her, no, it's just a joke. They don't really mean it. And so over time, she just starts to ignore it. It becomes wallpaper. And then without her really realizing it, she starts believing it because she's been bathed in these ideas over and over again. So she went from realizing her boyfriend was a fascist to joining Identity Europa, that white nationalist group, in 2 months, you know, and once she only lasted a year. But when she got out of it, it took her a while to realize what she believed was wrong. Like she understood that it was morally wrong, but it took her a long time to realize, like, oh, yeah, the Holocaust happened.
Wow. So some of these groups that have done this recruiting that present this sort of, you know, like we went to Brooks Brothers and got all the nice clothes, so we have respectability. We don't just look like the sort of redneck weirdos from yesteryear. You know, now we're professional racists. We're professional everything else you want to describe. Where are they now? I feel like we haven't really heard a lot in the news about Proud Boys or Identity Europa recently. Are you still tracking these people? Where are they today?
They have podcasts. Some have totally quit. Some have podcasts and they haven't been really able to generate the same kind of audience. Some have renounced it. You know, I've listened to a few podcasts where these guys are kind of bitterly complaining that they came up with all these ideas that are kind of animating mainstream politics right now. So for one example, there's this slogan, import the third world, become the third world. Within white nationalism, that meant that people from other countries were not genetically on par with European Americans, right? And so if you bring in people from those countries, you're going to make America like those countries that people are refugees from. And that was popular in white nationalist circles 15 years ago. But now you're hearing more mainstream people say it. Charlie Kirk said it. Donald Trump Jr. said it. And I'm not saying that these guys know where that slogan comes from, but it's in the ether. And I think people really need to pay attention to where these ideas and symbols come from. Like, don't just rattle off. Don't just bathe in these jokes if they're jokes, right? Think about where these concepts come from, because oftentimes it's a dark place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important for people to hear this because they probably do not want their political party or their movement to be, you know, affected or even taken over by these people, right? And yet that is what the threat is. I mean, it's right there in the title of your book about how this stuff has captured American politics. Can you tell us more about how that happened in your view?
I think the extremist websites that I tracked, message boards, and Twitter sometimes, it kind of functioned as a test market for ideas, right? It's like totally free, and the most catchy ones rise to the top. So in a way, like, if you're a cynical person, you can see what really captures people's imaginations first in these places, and then it moves into the mainstream. For example, critical race theory, that was popping up in this world that I cover long before it ever made it to mainstream cable news. Mm-hmm. The first person who ever sent me a picture of Drag Queen Story Hour, whatever you might think of it, okay, was a self-described teenage fascist troll in 2017, years and years and years before this became an animating part of our politics. Like, these guys, especially the white nationalists that I interviewed, they thought the old Republican and Democratic parties didn't have anything to offer. They wanted something anti-war, and they wanted something that projected strength, right? There was a massive audience for that. And the mistake that they made was going all the way, going full racist. They learned, like, this movement learned that you need to be a little bit more subtle about that, and you can still maintain these ideas of, like, more strict controls from the government, more authoritarian power, less friendliness towards immigrants and outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a reader, Ellie, I really began to feel empathy for many of the people that you interviewed, people who I didn't ever think I'd really have empathy for, people like Richard Spencer, Jason Kessler, some of these really toxic people, villains, actually, when you understand their journey, you can begin to see, wow, you know, underneath all this hate and malevolence, there is a real person, a child of God, that in some ways is also a victim. I'm curious, did you experience empathy in the moment as you were getting to know these people, or is it something that only came to you later once you kind of had a fuller picture of their story?
Even early on, the first time I would call these guys, they would be really hostile. It was very unpleasant. But if I could just sit through that for 10 or 15 minutes, they'd calm down and they'd start telling their story. And everybody wants to tell their story. Everybody's got their own narrative. And so over time, I started to be accepted as a presence, you know, like just through familiarity. Like they became kind of obsessed with me. I was like a meme to them. But they also wanted to talk to me, to like get a interaction with that meme. But with so many of them, you learn their life stories and you're like, oh man, if like things just broke a different way, you'd be a totally different person. They're not stupid. I mean, none of these people are stupid. They are often selfish. And when I interview people who left and who fully say, like, this was wrong, I wish I hadn't been part of this, they always left because something personally hurt them within this world, within the movement, as they call it. Somebody stole their girlfriend. Somebody thwarted their ambition. They wanted to lead the group, and they didn't get to be the number one guy. You know, only after that pushed them out of that world did they start to reflect on, like, oh, man, that whole idea, that was pretty toxic. In fact, one of the man I interviewed in Charlottesville, Christopher Cantwell, he later became known as the crying Nazi, for obvious reasons. You know, he went on his podcast after he was in jail for more than a year. And he said, separated from that daily propaganda of racism, you know, he realized, like, that kind of warps your mind. Like, maybe it's not the most important thing to obsess over every single day is race, you know, but like, what does it say that the guy has to go to prison to come to that realization?
Indeed. Great. I have just a few minutes left before I want to take a commercial break here, Ellie, and we'll come back and kind of wrap up after that. But what have you experienced as a journalist at the intersection of this black-pilled ideology and real-world violence? I mean, you've been right in it. on a couple occasions. Yeah. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was at Charlottesville. I was at some violent other protest between white nationalists and anti-fascists. That was January 6th. It has been shocking. I never lost that feeling of feeling shocked when you see it up close, when you see people fighting. And it's not like on TV. They're not elegant. It's awkward and weird and strange. And it's pretty dark. But the hardest thing for me to handle is every once in a while hearing someone I know, someone close to me, sort of gesture at one of these ideas. That is so much more difficult for me to handle and to keep my cool around than with a stranger or an interview subject. You know, then I can stay professional. I can stay neutral, you know, just report what they're actually saying and what they're doing.
Yeah.
But when someone close to me starts talking about, well, maybe IQ is a really important way of analyzing someone's value to society, you know, that's what really gets to me.
Yikes. Great. All right. We'll pause there for a moment. My guest is Ellie Reeve, author of a book I read just a little while ago. It's called Black Pill: How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics. We'll have more after this. If you want to react to anything you've heard so far, shoot me a text on the Okunard Jewelers Talking text line. It's 504-260-1870. May have an opportunity also to take a call here in a little bit, so go ahead and get lined up now, and I'd be happy to speak to you after I'm done with this interview. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot on WWL. Be right back. Just a few minutes left with Ellie Reeve. Ellie, thanks for sticking around on the text line here. I've got a listener, Kathy in Metairie, who is asking a question I was going to ask, but I'll let Kathy ask it. Kathy wants to know, how do you know if a loved one is in one of these groups?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, the internet history, you might not necessarily have access to their phone. A lot of people will focus on little symbols, like the OK symbol was something people were really worried about for a while. I think that's overblown. I think it's a lot more important to just listen to how they talk. Listen to how they talk about other people. And if there's this kind of smug smirk, like that trollishness is very much a part of this internet culture. Like, again, that's another thing where I feel like now I've got congressmen and senators who all want to be Twitter trolls. It's a little weird, but like that attitude is very much was born in these extremist circles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're worried about someone being part of that, don't stop talking to them.
Don't stop. Stay engaged,
no.
Right? Ask questions.
Stay engaged. Mm-hmm. Or they're just going deeper into their bubble where no one is going to tell them that they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I live it every day, Ellie. So we know that it's not always a one-way trip for a lot of these people. I mean, you've already named a couple people, you know, in reporting in our conversation that, you know, took their own sort of white pill or whatever the opposite of the black pill is. Like, they did come back from the brink and said, oh, my God, I was taken advantage of. I was mistaken. I was misled. I was exploited. To what degree is it possible for us to do that proactively without them having to go to jail or lose their job or lose their family first? You know, how can we be proactive about this?
You got to stay in conversation with people you feel like are going that way and never insult their intelligence because they'll just shut down and stop talking to you. And it's even kind of the culture within this world to think the people who believe this stuff are the smart ones, the high IQ ones, the ones who aren't like sheep who've taken the blue pill from the matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So you just got to keep engaging people in conversation and reminding them that there's a whole world outside that bubble. You know, like that meme of touching grass, like that's real.
Yeah.
That's real. Like, especially if you're talking about a teenage kid, like take them outside, show them the beauty of the real world.
I find myself telling people on this program sometime to touch grass. I have to tell myself to touch grass. Because, you know, I don't think I'm black-pilled, but I certainly have my nose in my phone all day long, you know, reading the worst, to quote from your book, the worst possible explanation for events in my lifetime. And you got to get away from that stuff physically, psychologically.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah. And the way to do that is get outdoors, do anything but be on your computer or your TV, right?
That's right. I mean, I feel it too. You know, my phone is a rage machine. I can, I get so sucked into it, and then I look up and like, there's my little, I have a 1-year-old with his beautiful face. And I think about like, what is in my power to make a better world for my kid? And that's how I try to, you know, keep a sane head about it. I mean, there, I have had times where I thought like, are these guys going to win? Are they going to capture, you know, a majority of Americans? And it helps to talk to regular people. I interview normal people all over the country about what they think about politics. And no, the vast majority are good people who want to see good things happen for their neighbors and their families. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important to remember.
Yeah. Do you think the media does a good job of talking about this? Are we underreacting? Are we underreporting? What, one of the things that struck me about your book was like, this all seems so self-evident. You know, it's just right underneath the surface, and we're all just constantly, we're in this 24-hour outrage distraction machine, and nobody is really able to kind of point at this as the most plausible, likely explanation for why things are the way they are.
Yeah, I mean, the immediacy of the news, I mean, I work at CNN, you know, it's hard to think in the medium term about cultural trends that are changing and shaping the world. And when I started reporting on this in 2016, the prevailing opinion was, don't talk about it, don't give it oxygen, because that'll make it grow. And if we ignore it, it'll suffocate and die. Well, that's just not the reality with the internet. You know, if you aren't talking about it and exposing it for what it is, it's able to grow in its own world in these like self-contained social media bubbles. And it gets very big before the average person realizes it. I mean, when I went down to Charlottesville, my boss told me to be emotionally prepared for the story to never air, because it was happening over a summer weekend and it probably would be old news by that Monday.
Yeah.
You know, like even at that time, it was really hard to convince people that like, this is a big deal and we have to pay attention.
Just a couple more here, Ellie. I'm glad you were talking about social media. I wanted to ask you also about, you know, is there any serious effort by social media platforms to stop this kind of radicalization? Not the ideas themselves, right? We don't want censorship, but the sort of like algorithmic, you know, death spiral where people, it's a straight shot from what they're experiencing on X to them carrying a gun into a grocery store. Are social media platforms doing enough to stop that kind of thing from happening?
I think their efforts ebb and flow. You know, it used to be popular to say in the Silicon Valley world, like, we're all about free speech. Like about 15 years ago, Twitter said, you know, an executive said, we are the free speech wing of the free speech party. Then things started getting pretty tricky, right? Like Mark Zuckerberg used to allow Holocaust denial on Facebook, and then he took it off. And then, you know, there are these like tumultuous events that happened. There was more moderation, but now it's swung the other way. Now Zuckerberg is saying we're bringing back free speech on Facebook. I think I've been studying comedy podcasts a lot lately. And within that world, I've heard people describe those podcasts as a friendship simulator. That just sticks with me because it's so real. And people listen to hours and hours and hours of people, and it's like those people's thoughts become their thoughts. You know, I've read Reddit threads, you know, where the people are talking about these podcast hosts and the way they talk about them, it's as if they're a member of their family or their boyfriend or girlfriend. That relationship is so intense. And I think it can lead to a lack of questioning of the beliefs that those people are spouting.
Mm-hmm. 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 You know, my producer Coleman has a question for you. Go ahead, Coleman.
Yeah, while you were talking, we had a call, but the guy couldn't stay on. And of course, a lot of people like to hide into their political tribalism and do the whataboutisms. But do you find the same mentality that you see with the Proud Boys as in other groups that like to burn Teslas, or the guy that tried to assassinate Donald Trump, or the people that starts the autonomous zones? Like, is it specifically like right-wing radicals that go off into attention? Because a lot of people like to make these things political for some reason. And I know there's a differentiation from the actual right wing people and they don't want to be associated with this. But do you see the same mentality for those who do like blow up Tesla vehicles for whatever reason?
That is a great question. And I love that question. And it can happen to any system of belief. I haven't reported on the Tesla people, but I was in 2020, these protesters took over a part of Seattle and a police precinct evacuated. It was called the Chaz or the Chop. Okay. And at first that was a fun, good time. It was a party, but these kids, they were like online, they're in these chat rooms and they would trust people in these chat rooms that they later realized they shouldn't have been trusting. And there were constantly rumors that the Proud Boys were coming to try to hurt people inside the protests. So people started patrolling the perimeter with AR-15. And over time, the level of paranoia built up and up and up to where these kids felt like they were in a war zone. And I'm talking in less than a month. And again, within less than a month, some teenagers were driving a car, a white SUV, and they drove it into that area where the protesters were. And because people were so paranoid, they fired on that car and they injured what turned out to be not Proud Boys, not white supremacists, but two unarmed black teenagers. Meaning in just a few weeks, they had replicated the exact same thing that they were protesting. So yes, absolutely, this can happen to any in any political belief system. You have to be careful with who you trust online, and you have to step away from it and think about what ideas have you accepted without questioning.
That's great. Thank you. Great answer to a great question. Yeah, I think we can probably kind of end on this note that the expression of these movements and ideologies and happenstance that are explored in your book have kind of focused around what happened at Charlottesville and at January 6th, but it is not exclusive to them at all. And this is a thing that everyone should be concerned about, the radicalization that can happen in these sort of information bubbles, these online spaces that are where paranoia runs deep. And if you're not with us, you're against us, that sort of thing. This is a danger to everybody, left, right, and center.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not always ideologically radical. It can be tactically radical, meaning being willing to take up arms, storm the Capitol, whatever, do violence. You know, it's giving yourself an excuse to do what you would have believed was immoral, you know, only weeks or months before.
I could go on with you a lot longer, Ellie, but I know you're very busy and we've got to move on as well. But I want to thank you so much for being a part of the show today. Thank you for this book. I really enjoyed it. I've been recommending it to anybody who will listen. And I hope we can talk again sometime soon.
Okay, great. I had a great time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ellie Reeve is the author of Black Pill, How I Witnessed the Darkest Corners of the Internet Come to Life, Poison Society, and Capture American Politics, available wherever books are sold. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot. We got some business to catch up on, and then I'm going to come back and take some of your calls and read more of your texts. At 3:10, we'll talk to Mandy Landry. Be right back after this. Just about a minute here before we hand it off to Chris Miller in our news department. Not the Chris Miller who won tickets to Jazz Fest from WWL by listening for the code word of the day, which I will give out the 3 o'clock in the 3 o'clock hour, which is coming up here. You're going to take that code word and go to WWL.com/contests and enter to win. When we come back, we'll be speaking to Mandy Landry, Louisiana State Representative. The Louisiana legislative session has begun. We'll dive into what your lawmakers are hoping to get done and look back at the most and least successful policies from last time. What do you think the biggest priorities should be for your Louisiana legislators? We'll be back right after this. I'm Ian Hoken for Scoot on WWL.